What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for people who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Mazmi from Princeton University. Today, I'm here to talk to Professor Omar Hamid Ali, the author of Malik Ambar, Power and Slavery Across the Indian Ocean, published by Oxford University Press in 2016, part of A World in a Life series. Dr. Hamid Ali is a professor of Comparative African Diaspora History at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Through archival and ethnographic research, he explores issues of power and culture across the Atlantic and Indian Ocean worlds, from the early modern period to the modern period. He is the author of several books, including Islam in the Indian Ocean World, A Brief History with Document, which we will also talk about. By discussing the present book, Malik Ambar, we will gain a rare look at an individual who began in obscurity in the Horn of Africa and reached the highest levels of South Asian political and military affairs in the late 16th and early 17th centuries. Ambar's rise from slavery in the Horn of Africa to rulership in South Asia sheds lights on the diverse mix of people, products, and practices that shaped the Indian Ocean world during the early modern period. Originally from Ethiopia, historically known as Abyssinia, Ambar is best known for having defended the Deccan, which is in southern India, from being occupied by the Mughals during the first quarter of the 17th century. His ingenuity as a military leader, his diplomatic skills, and his land reform policies contributed to his success in keeping the Deccan free of Mughal imperial rule. Welcome, Omar, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. We would like to learn a bit about yourself, if you can speak about where you were born, where you went to school, how you became interested in your field of study, and if you had any mentors or scholars that you were influenced by.
Sure. So I was born in Lima, Peru, in South America. My mother is from Peru originally, and my father is East Indian. So Catholic mother, Muslim father, and I grew up in part in California, but also spent almost 5 years in North Africa and almost 3 years in the Middle East. And my academic training is, I started off at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where I studied cultural anthropology and political economy, and then went to the London School of Economics and Political Science, graduated from there, and then continued with my PhD in history at Columbia University. I worked closely with a Ghanaian anthropologist named Maxwell Owusu in West Africa, who was at the University of Michigan. And then I also worked closely with both Eric Foner at Columbia University, Aisha Jalal, who at that time was at Columbia, among other faculty members. And I really, I do world history with a focus on the global African diaspora.
Mm-hmm. So You published a number of books before the present one, Malik Ambar. How did this particular book idea develop? And if you can, tell us about the research process.
Sure. So my work crosses, in some ways, two vast areas of the world, the Atlantic world and then the Indian Ocean world. And I was working as I was teaching and doing research as a Fulbright professor at La Universidad Nacional de Colombia. This is in South America, in Bogota. And I was working with an anthropologist named Jaime Arrocha, who was the Center for Afro-Colombian Studies there. And he was very interested in sort of the role, the possible role of Muslims in Maroon and slave rebellion that were documented. And Sylviane Diouf, who's a very dear friend and colleague of mine, had written this magnificent book called Servants of Allah, and looking at Africans enslaved in the Americas. And so I began to focus more of my interest on the intersection of the African diaspora and Islam, and looking at slave resistance through the eyes of Muslims, Muslim Africans who were enslaved. And there is a long history of that going back to the earliest rebellions in the Americas, in Hispaniola and also in New Granada, which is now modern day Colombia. And I looked at, you know, the work of Muslims in the Mali Revolt in Brazil, and began to see the importance of Muslims in combating slavery, or trying to self-liberate. And so my work in West Africa with Professor Maxwell Owusu began to tie me more to the continent and began migrating, if you will, over to East Africa. My family is from India and parts of Pakistan, but mostly in India. And I had lived in the Middle East, and I was familiar with some of the cultures there. And so I began to explore this, the role of Muslims and Africans in that part of the world. And the person that came up over and again was Malik Ambar. And there had been three, four biographies written, one based on a dissertation in the 1930s and several others in the 1960s and early 70s by Indian, South Asian scholars. But there hadn't been work done beyond a chapter or shorter papers by people like Richard Eaton in the United States or in the Atlantic world, and he was less known in this part of the world. So I wanted to bring the extraordinary story of Malik Ambar to light and bring out much more of the social history and bring out much more of what I reconstructed in terms of its the African history, the part of his life in Ethiopia, or as you said, as it used to be referred to as Abyssinia. And so I brought out more of that social history and started looking at certain people that were at that time, people like Chan Bibi and others, to start to write a story. That's what we do as historians, we write stories. And I wanted to make it an accessible story. And so Oxford published this biography, which is part of the World in a Life series, as you mentioned. And I would love for everybody to know who's studying world history to know about Malik Ambar and people certainly who were working on the African diaspora to understand that there is a very rich African diaspora in the Indian Ocean world. Most people focus on the Atlantic world that precedes the Atlantic by a good 15 centuries in terms of the documentary evidence, going back to the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea. So the story of Malik Ambar is utterly fascinating, I mean, to me, and it was based on field work in Ethiopia and in India and archival work in various places and speaking to many different scholars and really trying to pull out elements that were less known. A lot of what has been written about him has been military history, and that's been the main focus. But I wanted to bring out other aspects of his extraordinary life.
And you've definitely accomplished that in this very accessible short book that made his life much more, I would say, vibrant and animated.
Thank you.
Well, let's get Let's get to know Malik Anwar. The book is organized chronologically in 9 short chapters, followed by very helpful study questions and short primary source excerpt, which makes it really good for a classroom. The first chapter, Oromo, Abyssinia, and War. Can you introduce us and situate Malik Anwar in his Abyssinian context and, in broad strokes, the history of the slave trade that you alluded to between the Red Sea and the broader Indian Ocean in the early modern period?
Mm-hmm. So he was Oromo ethnically, which is one of the 3 major ethnic groups in Ethiopia. There are, you know, over 80 distinct languages spoken, many different ethnic groups, and even really nations within nations in Ethiopia. Very diverse part of Africa. I mean, Africa as a whole is extremely diverse, but Ethiopia is especially diverse. And he was born at a time, so this is the mid-16th century, which is just in the wake of these wars between Muslim Ethiopians on the coast, part of the Adal Sultanate, and the Christian Ethiopians that were up in the highlands. And the Oromo people that he was part of were coming up from southern part of Ethiopia, and he had and his family had migrated, settled into the area of Hararghe. And it's not clear what the conditions were exactly under which he was made a slave. A couple of authors say that he was sold by his parents into slavery. Again, this is speculation. What I believe probably happened was that he was part of, you know, the wars that were going on and slave raiding, and he was captured as part of others in his family and his group of people in Hararghe. And he was, but what we do know is that he marches to the coast and is taken to southern Arabia, and then from there goes up to Baghdad. But the context in Africa is such that there is ongoing wars, that people are moving around. The Oromo have adopted horses and are fighting back. In some ways, they have enemies on both the Christian side and the Muslim side in the coast and in the highlands. And these are all Ethiopians. These are, you know, Ethiopians. They're not Europeans coming in or people that are, you know, from the Arab heartlands. They're people who have adopted Islam on the coast and Christianity, which entered into Ethiopia as early as the 4th century. These are the conditions under which he's living in, and I try to portray that and create that context in that early chapter.
He's definitely, exceptional character in many ways, but also really speaks of a broader historical, experiences at this time by experiencing involuntary mobility across southern Arabia, as you've mentioned in chapter 2, Mocha, Baghdad, and beyond, all the way to South Asia. So in what ways the racial identity of Malik Anwar mattered, and how was it incorporated within the Indian caste system once he reached South Asia?
So there's some great questions. So he in some ways is brought into the military slave system that is part of the Western Indian Ocean world, that we're essentially taking people from the Horn of Africa to different parts of the Middle East and to South Asia. And race, in some ways, has been very much defined by sort of our Atlantic understanding of the construction of race, which is, as I always say, it's not just a social construct. Everything is a social construct. And it's also based on power. I mean, that's the issue. The categories that are created for racial distinctions is based on power, who has the power to create those things. Not to say that the subaltern don't have a role, but the oppressed don't have a role in that. But it's dominated by a particular those who are in power. And so race looks different in that part of the world. I mean, the notion of being Black and it necessarily meaning that you're a slave did not hold true there, because there were people who had ascended to great heights of power who were not enslaved. And many of those, and slavery itself looks very different in that part of the world compared to the Atlantic world. There's a lot more malleability. Like, so you have people who are technically slaves who are ministers and regent ministers in the case of Malik Anwar, but also not just in South Asia, but in other parts of the Middle East, you have people who are rising to power who are technically slaves. This is not to romanticize or glorify slavery in any way, because it's a system fundamentally based on violence. I mean, people are enslaved. It's a violent act. And there were many different kinds of slaves. Women were, you know, served as concubines, but there were also people who were working in all kinds of areas as slaves, like pearl divers, but also working on farms and in other capacities as domestic workers. But race does have a role in the sense that there is a borrowing, if you will, of racial concepts that begins to go into the Indian Ocean world. And it's not to say that it's universally held that, you know, this idea of blackness is inferior, because you have these cases of not just Malik Ambar, but Ilkhaz Khan and others, these Abyssinian nobles, and they're portrayed in these beautiful portraits. There was a wonderful exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art on some of these portraits, but they're in the, you know, the Victoria Albert Museum at the Louvre, and then in the British Museum and the Metropolitan and other museums. I mean, you have these extraordinary portraits, and of course, in South Asia, that depict blackness as not just synonymous with slavery. So it's a mix of influences, and it's a transitional period, if you will, because the Atlantic world is beginning to make this very close connection between blackness and enslavement. That would happen in another century or so, fully with the racial codification of slavery and the Chesapeake, and then scientific racism thereafter that connects that blackness with enslavement and status, sort of lower status among humans. But Malik Ambar was somebody who was ascended to power because he was an extraordinarily talented leader in terms of his military abilities, in terms of his administrative capacities, in terms of his diplomatic skills, and would end up ruling as the de facto ruler for about 25 years because of that. And he was not just the only Abyssinian. There were numbers of others as depicted in those images. So there was a range of experiences of slavery, a range of ways in which race was constructed, which were not just about sort of blackness being inferior. It was more complicated than that.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Definitely. I mean, from this, we learned that race did not really preclude social mobility, if I can say. But however, we have to be always cognizant of social hierarchies and power structures during this time. In chapter 3, The Deccan and Military Slavery, the life of Malik Ambar in many ways sheds light on the contour and history of military slavery in South Asia and the possibilities that it offered for somebody like Malik Ambar in terms of identity, mobility, and career. And that becomes part of South Asian history once we move to chapter 4 and 5, in which Ahmednagar and fidelity to salt, and in chapter 5, rebels, regency, and race. In what ways the entanglements of between Malik Ambar and Mirak Dabir, Nizam Shah, and Chand Bibi that you mentioned shaped the trajectory of Malik Ambar's life and career in the Ahmednagar Sultanate?
Well, Malik Dabir, who also went by Genghis Khan, was an Abyssinian himself, and he had become a regent and minister, and had, according to the records, 1,000 slaves. So this was a very powerful figure in the Deccan and specifically the Sultanate of Ahmednagar. And it looks like he took Malik Ambar under his wing. And in some ways, probably identified his talents and wanted to cultivate them. And it was because of, I think, that relationship that he was able to develop even further, that is, Malik Ambar was. And his Malik Dabir was actually poisoned, killed, and Malik Ambar had to basically leave. And that's at the point where he basically becomes a mercenary and starts to amass a following and becomes a mercenary general and serves multiple courts and obviously develops even further in terms of his leadership abilities, military skills, and what have you, and is commanding now large numbers of people, cavalry force, soldiers that are both Abyssinian and Maratha, you know, Hindus. And it's a fascinating transition. He works for a time under the command of Chand Bibi, who is an extraordinary female leader in the Deccan, who is somebody who prides herself on trying to defend the Deccan from Mughal incursions from the north. So the imperialist Mughals were trying to push down into the Deccan, and she famously is sort of in this holdout in this fort. And as I described there, and based on the documentary sources, that, you know, there's a breach in the walls, and she takes off her veil and puts on armor and starts to go right at the breach. And her bodyguards and people who had started to run away see her bravery and turn around and join her. And they're able to fend off for a while, the Mughals. But Malik Ambar is somebody who's observing this sort of the heroism of Chand Bibi and develops in some ways this sort of desire to maintain the independence of the Deccan from Mughal rule. But he's also, in the dissolution of the Bahmani states, he is dealing with multiple sultanates that are at times friendly to each other, at times at war with each other. So he's having to kind of pull together multiple kingdoms, sultanates, together to try to fend off the Mughals. And he develops, you know, guerrilla-style warfare called Barigiri, which uses striking cavalry force, and then they retreat and then they come back. And he builds fortresses and reinforces fortresses in the area, and just is very masterful at keeping enough of the forces in the area together at critical moments to keep the Mughals out. And if the Mughals do take over parts of the land, they aren't able to maintain control of it. So an extraordinary leader in many ways, who is influenced by Malik Dabir, who's Abyssinian, by Chand Bibi, and the princesses, who rises as a regent minister herself and takes over from her brother. And you know, the role of the person who is the actual ruler in Nizam Shah is basically somebody who he installs when they get to the age of around early adolescence, 12, 13, they end up dying. And he does this two or three times. So this is not to say that he was certainly not a saint, Malik Ambar. He was somebody who was politically cunning, and he did what he believed he needed to do to maintain control. And so he essentially installed one after another king and served as the de facto ruler, as regent minister, for a quarter of a century.
Mm-hmm. And you say more about that in chapter 7, the people and the battle of Batavadi. So how did the conflicts of the Mughals and the Marathas unfold in chapter 6 and 7? And what were the roles of Malik Ambar in this battle and this larger conflict?
So, you know, one of the very interesting things that I try to bring out in the book is the role that he played, that is, Malik Ambar played, in terms of commanding Hindus and Marathas in particular in his armies. And that some of the grandparents of Shivaji, who's the great Hindu warrior, is influenced, is under the command of Malik Ambar, and surely learned from him and deepened their understanding of military affairs, being under Malik Ambar's general command. And so there is this very interesting line from, you know, the sort of the fierce independent spirit of Chand Bibi to that of Malik Ambar to Shivaji that I draw. And I just think that there's that itself is a fascinating story because it brings together a very diverse group of people who are influenced by each other. But the Mughals ultimately do take over. They, within a couple of years after Malik Ambar passes away, his son is not able to keep them at bay, and they do come in. And I think it's because he wasn't able to carry out the multiple roles and abilities of Malik Ambar in terms of his diplomacy skills, in terms of the general administration, and his military prowess. And so it's the confluence of those different skills that allowed him to keep the Deccanese independent for the time that he was around. But ultimately, the Mughals do take over the area and impose themselves on the region.
Mm-hmm. Besides his military career, you also shed light on justice, land reform, and legacy as well. So what were some of the features of Malik Ambar's governance, his infrastructural investments, and legacy in the Deccan, as well as that of his offspring and the Siddi community, which also originated from the Horn of Africa and East Africa?
Yes. So perhaps one of the most important things that he did was to give more control to essentially the peasants, the farmers, the local population in terms of what they would yield from their own crops. People became more invested in developing their own crops because they were getting more of it back. And so it was smart because by in some ways giving people the incentive to have more to keep for themselves and less taxes, it produced a lot more. And so it was, if you will, a win-win. And so I'm not saying that he was necessarily beloved, but he was somebody who had the admiration and respect of many people in the area. I think that is something that you can say, because even his the Mughal chronicler who talks about Malik Ambar upon his death speaks about him with just extraordinary respect. And I think that translates not just at the higher levels of the Mughal court, but I think among just ordinary people in the Deccan who benefited from Malik Ambar, the stability that, to the extent there was stability in the region, Malik Ambar provided that and offered greater returns on their own work of their own fields. So that was a very important move. And also, you know, the work that he did to not build necessarily new fortifications, but to reinforce existing fortifications and to create communication systems and pathways across the area. And so we have this documentary evidence from, you know, from Dutch merchants and other travelers, in addition to the records from the Deccanese and the Mughals.
Mm-hmm. As much as I would like this conversation to keep going, I would like to ask you, who do you hope will read this book and what sort of impact would you like it to have?
Well, I'm really happy to say that it's been picked up by a number of scholars and people around the world. And it's just been such a pleasure and honor to be parts of conversations where people are beginning to appreciate just how extraordinary Malik Ambar is, and somebody who can draw attention to the African diaspora in the Indian Ocean world and begin to sort of deconstruct notions of race and slavery in comparison to the Atlantic world. But the book is a value, I think, has been a value, and I hopefully will continue to be a value to teachers and then scholars. But you had mentioned that in the back there's the primary sources and questions, and I had actually convinced Oxford to have primary sources, because it's important that students and others who are studying this, because there's many people say who are scholars who aren't as familiar with this part of the world who want to learn about it, but you want to provide them with the primary sources. Where is this information coming from? So there's over, you know, about a dozen or so sources that are listed there, excerpted in translation with a little bit of context in the back, which I think has been particularly valuable for people to see themselves as not only the sort of the consumers of history, but also the producers of history. I mean, we're reconstructing stories. That's what we do. And so I'm trying to tell the story of Malik Ambar on the building on the shoulders of great giants and scholars before me in a way that's accessible to people and show those connections to other great Black leaders in the global African diaspora.
Talking about primary sources, can you tell us a bit about your other book, Islam in the Indian Ocean World, A Brief History with Documents, published by Bedford in 2016? And what are your current and future projects or what you hope to work on?
Thank you. So that book, Islam in the Indian Ocean World, which is looking at sort of the documentary sources in a number of areas in terms of the Islamic world from the 7th century going forward, is trying to pull together, pulls together documentary sources from South Asia, the Middle East, and East Africa. And partly why Bedford St. Martins was interested in the project is there hadn't really been any documentary source book that pulled together sources from these three different areas. You have documentary sources from East Africa, collections, or from the Middle East, or from South Asia, but not together. So this brings it all together in a unique way. And I have a very long introduction that kind of goes through the different areas of this history. But again, tools for teachers and for scholars to use to delve more as creators and writers of history themselves. My latest project actually is a three-volume series called Afro-South Asia in the Global African Diaspora. It's quite a mouthful. I'll say it again. It's the Afro-South Asia in the Global African Diaspora. And it includes about 34 contributors. And my co-editors include art historians, Muslim Islamic scholars, anthropologists, it's been a wonderful project that has included many different kinds of people from different disciplines to shed a very bright light on the role of, again, Afro-South Asians as part of this global African diaspora, the connections between parts of East Africa and South Asia, African Americans and South Asia, West Africans and South Asia. And, with the recent selection of the vice presidential candidate under Joe Biden of Kamala Harris, I just wanted to note that she is Afro-South Asian and she is part of the global African diaspora. She is of Jamaican, Black, and East Indian background. And I think that there are these really interesting connections that people don't necessarily think about because sometimes, East Asians are put over here while Africans are put over there. And I think that there's more and more evidence of just the extraordinary interplay between Africans and South Asia across the global diaspora. So that's a three-volume series, and it is out on Amazon, and we'll be doing a little bit of promotion over the coming period. Perhaps my co-editors, Kenneth Behrushov and Jasmine Grays, could come on and maybe do something. But it's been a great project, and it's a good moment because the exhibit that I had done online with Sylviane Diouf on the African diaspora in the Indian Ocean world at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, part of the New York Public Library, is now being phased out. And so this is a good moment to kind of draw some new attention to this African diaspora in that part of the world. So that's a new project. Mm-hmm.
That sounds fantastic. And we would love to have you again talking about the other book.
Great.
Thank you for sharing the fascinating life of Malik Ambar with us today. And I hope this draws attention to really unexplored and untapped history of connections between South Asia and Africa. Thank you for listening to today's episode in which we explored Malik Ambar, Power and Slavery Across the Indian Ocean, published by Oxford University Press in 2016. This is your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.